It was a bright and sunny morning on the island of Sodor when Thomas the Tank Engine woke up at Tidmouth's sheds, troubled by strange dreams. The first thing he noticed was that it was unusually quiet, and none of the other engines were around. Thomas was worried. It wasn't like him to oversleep. He rushed to collect his coaches, Annie and Clarabelle, but when he arrived at their shed, they were already gone. "I must be very late," thought Thomas. "Someone else must be doing my job." Unsure of what to do, Thomas rushed to find Sir Topham Hatt and apologize for his tardiness. On his way to the station, he saw his friend Percy coming the other way. Thomas stopped to greet his friend, but when Percy saw him, he let out a scream and rushed away as fast as his wheels would carry him. "Something very important must be going on," thought Thomas. And he went on his way to find Sir Topham Hatt. At Knapford Station, he saw Gordon about to leave with the express. "Hi, Gordon," Thomas greeted him cheerfully. But Gordon averted his eyes as if he'd seen something he shouldn't have, and chugged away quickly. "What's gotten into everyone today?" thought Thomas. As Gordon's express pulled out, he saw Annie and Clarabelle at the far end of the station. "Oh, good, I'll see who's pulling my branch line," thought Thomas. But when Gordon's steam cleared, he saw that the engine pulling Thomas's branch line was Thomas. This other Thomas gave him a smirk and pulled out of the station before Thomas could say anything. Thomas tried to catch up to him, but found his way blocked by James. "James, please move. I want to get through." But James didn't listen, and Thomas found that Henry was right behind him. Together, they forced Thomas down the track. "Where are you taking me? What's going on?" asked Thomas. James refused to answer, but Henry whispered, "I'm sorry, Thomas." "What's going on, Henry?" "We're taking you to the scrap yards."
"Why? What's all this about?"
"Don't talk to him," snapped James. Henry sighed and kept pushing Thomas forward. Soon a junction came up.
"I've got to find out what's happening before they send me for scrap," thought Thomas.
He gave a mighty push right at the junction and pushed James off the tracks. With as much steam as he could manage, Thomas sped forward. Henry tried to keep up, but Thomas soon lost him with some clever turns. Late into the night, Thomas wandered the island, avoiding other engines, resting and refueling where he could. He was greatly distressed and very tired.
"I just want to be useful again, to pull my branch line and to help my friends," he thought.
Slowly, he snuck back to Tidmouth's shed, hoping to see someone who might be able to help him. In the light of the shed, he saw the false Thomas in his place, talking cheerfully to the other engines, as if he belonged there. They even called him Thomas, and acted like nothing strange was happening.
"Gotcha!" cried James from behind as he pushed Thomas forward into the light. Thomas tried to get away, but found his path blocked by Gordon, and soon was chained to Gordon's rear and hauled forward, back to the scrapyards. Thomas tried to break free, tried to reverse, but Gordon was too strong and pulled him forward anyway. At the scrapyards, Sir Topham Hatt was waiting.
"Thomas, by trying to run away, you have caused confusion and delay. It is time for you to be useful again."
"But I am still useful," cried Thomas.
"There are lots of ways to be useful," said Sir Topham Hatt, and he nodded to his men. With drills and welding equipment, they came at Thomas, tearing up his face, puncturing his sides, scorching his boiler. Gordon tried to roll away, but Sir Topham Hatt told him to stay and watch as Thomas screamed. Late in the evening, Hours before dawn, Thomas rolled out of the scrapyard. To his face was attached hideous metal jaws. His eyes were open wide, unblinking, the lids removed. Gordon watched as he pulled out. "Thomas, I..." But when those eyes looked at him, he swallowed his words and rolled off meekly to the sheds to rest. Thomas did not head to the sheds. That was no longer the place for him. He rolled silently down the tracks into the dark, moonless night. His new cars were empty, but for the dangling metal hooks, it would be his job to fill every night for his new master. Not Sir Topham Hatt, but a controller much greater than he. Thomas let out no whistle, made no sound, lit no lamp. But he saw all and knew what he had to do. He rolled into the night to hunt, to be useful.
Tune in next week for another great Thomas and Friends story, where Thomas the Midnight Meat Train causes a race war between Steamies and Diesels. More stories like this here on the Post Culture Podcast.
Weeks on nights, 4 days off, maybe more hours if someone's off sick. The money's okay, better than fast food work, and he doesn't need to wash the grease off each morning. Start at 6, end at 6, fine in the summer, still some light at the beginning of shift, come out to the day starting. In winter it's dark when he goes in, it's dark when he comes out. Cold and wet, hiss from the highway. Flash of police lights from the accident up ahead. Last flight is scheduled for 10, bags are on the carousel by 11. Last passenger's gone by 12, 6 hours to clean and keep the place secure. Two other guys, one at each end of the small terminal. He holds the center, as the disinterested manager said, making some private joke, it seemed. College guys, always the same. Once in a while, a private jet. But this isn't Las Vegas. This ain't Monaco. Concession stands close up around 12, once the last passengers have their bags. Black bags, silver bags, red bags, bags wrapped in plastic, bags with ribbons on. Smiling passengers, grimacing passengers, frightened passengers. Coffee and a sandwich in a packet, fast walk outside, ready for a taxi. Cleaners really get to it from around 10:30, all gone by about 1. The taxis are cleared out by 1 in the morning, come back again around 4 or 5 as it all starts up again. Between 2 and 4, nobody. Nothing. Just his shoes squeaking across arrivals and departures. Zzzz sound from the fluorescence. He's got pepper spray, nightstick, rent-a-cop props. One day's training with a stick, a promise to one day get a taser. One of the other night guys used to be a cop. The professional attitude hides some kind of disgrace, or why would he be here? He should look it up. So, 2:45. Lights on outside. When he stands against the glass, he sees himself more clearly than the outside. Seeing himself more clearly is not what he's aiming for.
The bump and start of the carousel makes him jump, turn, hand on his nightstick, then laugh. The conveyor is turning, started up by one of the baggage handlers outside on the tarmac. Either they're fucking around, or there's a late private jet coming in. Those bags are usually taken directly from the aircraft to the car, but sometimes the rich out-of-towners want to take a taxi like anyone else, from the terminal. He glances through the terminal's glass front. Not much taxi action. Carousel is still grumbling along. The bag is obviously expensive, and obviously well-traveled. Battered, but not torn. Patina rather than damaged. No tags or labels, no colored ribbons or padlock. Big and filled with an irregular shape. Edges pushed against the material in places. He watches it go around twice, then radios outside to the handlers who don't pick up, predictably. He's still alone by the moving belt. As per SOP, after 45 minutes unclaimed, the bag goes to the unclaimed room. After feeling the weight, he brings over a trolley and slides it over, kicks the red stop button on the conveyor, wheels the bag over to the unclaimed, leaves the bag on the trolley, doesn't want to have to load it again. 3:30. He's filling out the unclaimed report in the book when there's a sound of sliding movement from the bag behind him. He turns fast, nearly knocks his coffee off the desk. But it's just the bag, and its contents settling into the trolley. His heart and breath are running at above the usual speed, and he laughs and shakes his head. Look at the brave security man. He'd have tasered the bag if he could. He laughs again. Think about the incident report involving a tasering passenger luggage. Another walk around arrivals, departures, squeak weak shoe on the floor. He's been tempted to do something stupid on many occasions, get a trolley, ride it like a cowboy across a smooth, shining space. CCTV on all the time. He'd only get to do it once. We need to be real stupid to throw this away. He's paying his way like a real adult, rent and food and gym and car. He hasn't had a real conversation with anyone in weeks. Sports bar camaraderie when there's a big game, maybe. Clothes are clean, he's neat, approachable. No one does approach, though. Maybe a holiday, a beach. Somewhere warmer, brighter colors, he can do that. Go online, just book something. Get fitter, healthier, happier. Get tan, say hi, with confidence. He's thinking about opening the baggage back and unclaimed, just to have a look. There's a corner of the room where the cameras don't have coverage. Just to have a look. He's got about 20 minutes before the building starts waking up again. Just have a look. After wheeling the trolley into the unobserved corner, he takes a deep breath. The tag on the zipper is solid, chunky, well-made. The teeth on the zip make a satisfying zzzup as he opens it. The man inside the bag is naked, quiet, curled up as if in a womb. He seems unfinished somehow. Eyebrows and hair color are nothing definite. Fingers are blank and unprinted. The face is certainly a face, but lacking definition. This is a template, not an individual. The eyes are open now, sort of transparent and unformed, but pupils dilating, contracting. He takes a step back and makes a sound, nothing specific, just letting air out of his body. The nightstick is in his hand, waving it ineffectually. He would laugh if he saw someone waving a nightstick at a pale man stepping out of a leather travel bag. He would laugh if he could see his own face as his back touches the wall. The figure touches his hand gently and seems to draw something from him. Features on the face now sharpening, becoming recognizable. Hair and eye colors are filling in a child's coloring book. The touch is so soft, but he can feel terrible changes in his body. The edges of his sight are darkening now. With one hand, the figure is unbuttoning his shirt, sliding the fabric from his shoulders. Now the hand is at his belt, his own hand, in front of his face, seems to be transparent. The automatic doors of the terminal swish open as he approaches, eyes taking in everything that is new. There are these new memories to take into account and refer to, but that doesn't need to be done today. The memories sit like objects in a box to be removed, looked at, discarded. A quiet space to get strong is required more than anything else. Car keys in the pocket sit next to the removed, unclaimed report page screwed into a ball. The travel bag is rolled up at the bottom of the dumpster in the back of the coffee shop. The car is ahead, on the wet ground. The sky is the area above the ground. Clouds move in. He hasn't had a real conversation with anyone in weeks.
Come all of you young people and live some while I tell a fate of boy Colin, a lad we all knew well. His face was fair and handsome, his heart was true and brave. His body now lies sleeping in a lonely sandstone cave. How sad this story, it filled our eyes with tears. This membrane too.
I was born shortly before my 18th birthday, and I'll die soon, a decrepit man at 35. I'm not being melodramatic or self-deprecating, like some hyperbolic asshole. And I definitely don't think every 35-year-old is deterministically decaying into rot. This is simply the reality of my shambled existence. Most humans who've roamed the Earth for almost 4 decades are not incorrect in referring to themselves as middle-aged. But while I might be a man, I am definitely not human. And my life is long past its halfway point. My skin is simultaneously hardening and dehydrating since my teenage rebirthday. At this point, I'm coated in such a thick patina of beef jerky, a more aged meat strip than man. About a year ago, the outermost layer began scattering off me in a powder aerosol, a permadust exfoliate clouding me in particulate. I feel like Pigpen from The Peanuts, forever drowning in my own effluvia. I can't remember a world anymore without epidermal motes swarming my immediate airspace, blurring my reflection into an angelic smudge, fuzzing my perception of everything outside my personal Oort cloud. Then a few weeks ago, small clumps of my ancient flesh, like teaspoonfuls of astronaut ice cream, started dropping off my bone limbs. I was working at my computer when a desiccated cheesy poof of body crust plopped from my forearm to the floor. More dive bombers have been quick to follow, with my body mass index plummeting in their wake. My disintegration seems to be at an end stage in acceleration. I've lost the ability to cohere, like one of those foam cores found at the center of a long-since dried-up floral display. My hands haven't had much flexibility for years, but I've managed to retain some typing ability. It's just poking the keyboard with my chopstick fingers, nowhere near as fluid as before I was affected, but feasible enough to complete my task. Unfortunately, much like my BMI, the efficacy of my starchy pecking has similarly plummeted off a cliff in recent weeks. It's defeating in the way I imagine Stephen Hawking must experience frustration. I've read it now takes him 10 minutes to input a single sentence into his voice modulator. To feel you have vital information trapped inside an increasingly failing delivery structure. I'm terrified my digits will snap off as I attempt to get my story down, crippling me before I finish telling it. Actually, let me take a step back. It might be better to reframe the entirety of my existence as one man whose time on Earth was subdivided into 2 separate lives, each less than a couple decades long. Things have always gone bump in the night, and I should tell you that many such bump-goers are beings like me. We have no mutually agreed-upon name, but I use the moniker affected. I suppose infected would work as well, perhaps better even, given that the origin of our change is bacterial. The crassness of that term simply never called to me. Once a person is exposed to the affecting bacteria, the transformation is rapid and unimaginably horrific. First comes the body's expulsion of all food, along with the human apparatus required to ingest it. Namely, it will be that person's last and most terrifying defecation. The most aptly named of bowel movements, actually including the bowels themselves, as well as the stomach, pancreas, liver, spleen, etc., 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 the reproductive organs wash out too. They simply no longer serve a purpose, and blood flow will quickly be at a premium. You can't go wasting liquid on vestigial tissue. And everything must go evacuation cleanse for the torso, except, of course, for the heart and lungs. Imagine your most violent human intestinal flu, and know that the experience was a mere tummy pinprick compared to the intensity of an affected's evisceration. After this mother of all monster shits, it's not uncommon for an affected's anus to close up altogether. It simply becomes dead space down there. So despite this bacterial source of what essentially boils down to biological warfare, reversal is simply not possible, even with antibiotics. Once changed, an affected's body can no longer support a human existence. Medical science can't bring back or recreate those necessary organs and their associated plumbing structure. At least not at present. The next and most obvious alteration is the thirst. It's ever unquenchable. The dehydration sets in almost immediately. This thirst manifests as a need for blood. When liquid evaporates from the affected's flesh, what remains grows sluggish. An affected must always stay ahead of the thirst, because once you're too slow to feed, time simply becomes a borrowed arrow. The body first hardens, then crumbles into dilapidation, much like the ruined husk I currently inhabit. It's therefore fortunate for the affected that most of Earth's creatures emit a scent which, for lack of a better analogy, allow the affected to acquire a dental hard-on. And with these elongated teeth, an affected can puncture skin to drain blood. Taking life-sustaining hydration for your own needy, greedy heart to distribute to wasted limbs in an increasingly failing brain. And as evolutionary luck would also have it, the bacterial infection creeping through the affected system emits an odor that causes humans, albeit not other animals, to enter a kind of fugue state. By taking advantage of this stupor, an affected may thus leech fluid from human bounty without a struggle. Most drained people awake the next morning assuming they must have blacked out from drunkenness or merely suffering a subsequent hangover. Yes, that's correct, not all fed upon creatures become affected. The bacteria has a flared up periodicity when it's communicable. And those times are actually quite infrequent. Unfortunately, an affected's thirst is never ending. And that need to quench the unslakable dominates your arid existence. It's rarely an affected's top priority to practice safe draining techniques with victims. I know of none who time a bite to the least infectious cyclical moment. I apologize if I'm constructing what appears to be an overly bleak tableau for humanity. I should interject here that not all is lost. Because amid all of this chaos of affecteds and humans and viscera and blood, there has always existed a hunter. When the affecting bacteria evolved a million years ago, there was one man who possessed two characteristics that made him incorruptible, and he took it upon himself to wage a war against the infected. First, this man did not emit the odor that allowed the affected's teeth to extend and thus drain blood. As such, no matter how much an affected might want to feed from a hunter, there was only impotence. But that alone would not have allowed this man to begin the hunting of affecteds. The smell from the bacteria that the affected gave off would still have rendered him useless if not for the second of his traits. Because as luck would have it, the hunter had no olfactory sense himself. His nose was entirely decorative and fully functionless. In the random probability numbers game of life, this man rolled biological snake eyes. The exact story of how he came to start hunting has been lost to time. What I do know is that he made sure to beget a single male offspring, and that child was also gifted with the same two traits of odorlessness. Neither a sniffer nor a sniffy bee, the child was trained to become a hunter for when his father passed. As an adult, this second hunter also ensured a duly gifted male progeny existed to be trained, and so on and so forth through the centuries. It's not clear, but it's suspected that over the years, female babies were likely slain at birth. It was believed in these sexist times that women were too delicate to lead lives of such violence, and the hunter role was deemed too valuable to permit the lion's demise before reproduction could occur. It clearly never dawned on any one of these moronic men that even if the girls didn't hunt, as long as they possessed the coexisting traits, they could have spawned additional children to increase the hunter population. A community or even an army of hunters might have allowed the bacterial strain to have been eradicated long ago. But Hunter Zero was not known to be a smart man. And unfortunately, the rules he passed down were quickly adopted as lore. I know all this because my father told me. And he knew it because he was the hunter. Just as I, his son, was hunter after him. Over the past 1,000 years, my relatives developed a kind of biological instinct, imperative even, for hunting. A deeply ingrained genetic need to destroy the feeding affecteds. As such, I've always wondered what would happen if I could achieve an affected's dental erection. Would I somehow feel compelled to take my own life? It's an interesting theoretical quandary, but moot nonetheless. I have no sense of smell, therefore my teeth cannot be aroused by the sense of other living creatures. You may wonder how I've survived so long with no apparatus by which to feed. The truth is that my mission is non-negotiable. I've simply had to make do. Admittedly, though, this existence has been horrific and has felt interminable. And the thirst has been excruciating beyond language. Throughout the ages, hunters have often sought companionship with canine sidekicks, and I too found benefit from a pet dog. And although it broke my desiccated heart, that animal also unwittingly served as my primary source of sustenance. I, of course, developed humane methods to gently anesthetize the creature and safely extract blood with minimal invasiveness. But my best friend's enervation the days after her drainings always made me despair myself. So strong is the urge to destroy the affected that in the early days after my change, I continued going out hunting. But I quickly acknowledged that my mission had to take priority, and I couldn't risk my own death. So to satiate this hunting need, I would instead buy rodents from pet stores to deliberately turn, then kill. During a flare-up, I once put some of the fluid from my mouth, salivas, not an apt term, on the end of a pin and stuck a fly. The insect swiftly escaped my grasp, and I feared it would find outlet from my apartment, potentially creating a mass epidemic. My windows were sealed, and I managed to destroy the bug, but not before terrifying myself with the thought it might discover freedom by slipping through a vent. I know what you're asking yourself at this point. You're wondering how I could have been turned into an affected given my natural defense. It's quite a reasonable question. The truth is that while I've never felt myself to be anything other than masculine, my body was born with female biology. It was the 1980s, though, and my dad certainly wasn't about to kill a baby girl. He raised me and trained me as he would any child destined to grow up to be a hunter. I actually suspect he might even have been grateful that I identified as male. He left my mother not long after I was born. I think he never quite felt comfortable with women. Whatever the case, it never came up between us. Just as my ancestors before me, I was born with both of the hunter's traits, a lack of smelling sense and an absence of the aroma that coaxes forth and affect its teeth for feeding. What was new for me in the long line of hunters, though, where extenuating circumstances surrounded my female biology, which temporarily opened me up to the bacterial infection. My father passed when I was 15. At 17, I knew it was time for me to reproduce and to begin the training process anew. A hunter's lifespan is sadly not long. I went to a bar downtown, met a gorgeous boy. His pretty face and skinny body dazzled me. I told him there was absolutely no worry of my becoming impregnated, which was true, because it was in fact my goal, not my concern. And I certainly had no intention of ever worrying him with a child. Oh, we had sex in the back bathroom. I bent over the sink, and he took me from behind. Despite what I've read about pain the first time, I found the experience quite enjoyable. I left Sticky with his ejaculate, clenching my kegels to keep his seed inside me. Luckily, I was young. Fertilization took. Unluckily, I am very quickly rode low and heavy, and my hunting abilities became impaired. During the 7th month of my pregnancy, I had an encounter when affected wherein I was knocked down. I then watched as my attacker's teeth grew, ready to sink into my flesh. I was still somehow able to kill it, but I retreated back to my apartment, deeply shaken. Something was happening to my body's chemistry. My most cherished and taken-for-granted gift of odorlessness had abandoned me. I could no longer rely on this trait to protect me, and I still had 10 weeks until my child was born. Aside from food deliveries, I mostly remained barricaded in my apartment. But while the internet had begun blossoming by this time, it was not yet in full bloom. There were necessities that required me to occasionally emerge. In my 8th month, the taps in my building were shut off and I had to stock up on bottled water. I tried to make the shopping jaunt a quick one, but of course an affected found me. By then, I felt as though my smell had become a beacon, perhaps more powerful than most humans. At least my lack of ability to smell in return allowed me to keep my wits. I fought as powerfully as I could, but I was so large by then, you'd have thought I was carrying a 4-year-old. The resulting expulsion of all my innards naturally included the gift I'd been carrying in utero. When I finally regained consciousness in that back alley, I was covered in my own entrails, and my thirst was already kicking in. But I saw the 2 cooing babies and knew I had to get my premature darlings to an ER. There was 1 boy and 1 girl, or at least that was their physiology. I have no idea how either has since chosen to identify. I managed to find a nearby hospital and left my disgusting bundles of joy out front by the ambulances. Most newborns are slathered in biological detritus, but I think mine may have truly repulsed the on-duty emergency medical staff. Aside from the copious smears of fecal matter, they would have also recognized the tissues from myriad internal organs. God only knows what they thought became of me. Forgive me for all my ramblings. But I finally arrived at my point. I've made it my task, these last 17 years, to document all of the information conveyed to me by my own father, a book to compile, explain, and detail the knowledge acquired of centuries of hunters. I've done this because I know you're out there. I've begun sensing you too, the way you used to sense my own father when we would hunt together. Your biological instinct clearly kicked in. You need to kill the affected. I can feel it in you, just as I can feel you coming for me now. You must be so confused by everything, which is why I wanted to include this explanatory preamble. I simply had no idea it would take me so many weeks to complete. I'd have preferred to communicate verbally when you arrived, but my tongue recently crumbled to powder in my mouth. It had been nothing more than a thick flap of sandpaper for years, but I never thought I'd miss it so much. Everything has become so challenging. My once quite formidable brain fails me more often than not. One of my eyes has been reduced to crumbs, and the other's vision is painfully dim. I just want it to last, somehow, until you get here, so I can look at you, my beautiful children, just once. I hope you're as pretty as that young boy from all those years ago. I hope my arms can make it too, so I may hold out my manuscript when you arrive. So I might even touch you, perhaps, and you'll know I'm your father.
My name was Douglas Earhart Anthony. I was an experimental physicist and head of the nuclear research lab at Stony Brook University in New York. 20 minutes ago, at 22:04 hours Eastern Time, a criticality accident occurred. I won't try to hide the details of my mistakes behind a wall of scientific jargon. I'll call it what it was. A colossal fuck-up. I've spent the last 26 years working with varying success to find new and better ways to protect astronauts from the dangers of cosmic radiation. I recently designed and constructed a shield that I believe will allow for indefinite space travel or occupation of Mars with no more harmful effects than normal background radiation on Earth. It was my intention to test this shield that I came to my research laboratory late on a long holiday weekend. The experiments I wanted to perform required a few, well, let's say, non-standard protocols. It's possible I might have bypassed a number of fail-safe mechanisms and disabled a few alarms. I certainly skirted around a few Nuclear Regulatory Commission statutes. I reasoned that if directly handling radioactive materials was good enough for Rutherford, Curie, and Oppenheimer, and damn it, it was good enough for me. I was tired of standing on the shoulders of giants, and was ready to take my rightful place amongst their number. Unfortunately, the shoulders of the giants on which I stood were the same shoulders of the giants from which I fell. In my haste to prove the worth of my breakthrough, I allowed a small brick of tungsten carbide to contact a sphere of fissile uranium. It slipped from my fingers for just a moment. The click of metal on metal. A brief flash of blue phosphorescence. The tungsten carbide reflected enough neutrons back into the uranium that critical mass was achieved. The uncontrolled cascade of nuclear fission lasted mere milliseconds, but released a burst of gamma and beta radiation that killed me as surely as a bullet to the brain. I've calculated that I absorbed at least 8 gray of radiation during the colossal fuck-up. If this were a comic book, perhaps this chain of events would be my origin story. I'd feel my muscles swell with superhuman strength, or my flesh become elastic or invisible, or my brain enlarge, crackling with telekinetic power until it throbbed visibly beneath my skin. But alas, my universe is subject to the laws of physics, not the imagination of Stan Lee. 8 gray is more than enough to do me in. My heart still beats, my lungs still breathe, but I am a dead man. My exquisite cellular machinery
no longer functions, its DNA rendered into a billion, billion, billion useless knots of deranged atoms. No more mitosis. No more new proteins. No more repair of oxidative damage. I am a supernova whose explosive light has not yet reached your eyes, so you can see the star I once was. I already feel the expected headaches and nausea. Can see my skin turning the slapped, pinkish-red of an early summer sunburn. My bone marrow is useless jelly, unable to produce white blood cells I need to defend against infections. I may have a week or two, but inevitably, I'll succumb to either septicemia or systemic organ failure. The silver lining is that any latent cancer in my body has surely been obliterated. I, for one, will not miss the indignity of annual colonoscopies and digital rectal exams. I can see that bottle of good scotch I brought on the monitor. It sits on a table not 3 feet from the other side of the exit, tantalizingly close. The door, of course, is sealed shut. Its locks tripped the moment computers realize that it's hotter than Chernobyl inside. Next to the scotch is a first edition copy of a Richard Feynman autobiography, whose words would bring more comfort to me now than I could find in any Bible. Anyone listening to this recording expecting a suicide message will be disappointed. My personal problems are no secret. My wife of 32 years recently divorced me, leaving me alone and penniless. It's true I've had my share of dark moods and my many setbacks and failed experiments while designing my shield have sometimes left me discouraged, desperate. But I will not have anyone thinking this colossal fuck-up was an intentional act, sparked by some emotional collapse. Likewise, anyone looking for an account of my personal spiritual journey through the five stages of grief will also come up empty-handed. Only a simpleton could look at these charts and hear the screaming Geiger counters and still deny a lethal criticality event transpired. Anger and depression would be illogical and futile, as would the bargaining with an unfeeling and absent God. If acceptance of my fate is what you want to call it, so be it, although it'd be more accurate to say I find myself without any more shits to give. It will be another 76 hours before anyone else arrives in the lab. What a mess they'll find. Pathetic old scientist, weak from hunger and thirst, and worse, skin slowing off in sheets, covered in his own vomit and bloody diarrhea. My irradiated remains will soon be a foul slurry in a lead-lined coffin. The sun is a cruel beast. It's sheer luck that no one living on the International Space Station or traveling to the moon has been blasted with fatal doses of cosmic radiation from a solar flare. Any future pioneers to Mars and other extraterrestrial bodies will have a significantly reduced lifespan, falling prey to leukemias, lymphomas, and 100 other ghastly neoplasms. My shield will protect them. I know it will work. My mother used to sing to me about sunshine. The blue glow that suffuses the air and the proximity of a criticality event is really quite remarkable. With it comes a faint whiff of ozone. Only a handful of people have been lucky enough to experience it as closely as I have. None of them have lived more than a month after. I've seen it twice now. The second burst of radiation was of considerably greater magnitude than the first. approximately 54 gray. I'll freely admit to causing this one deliberately. I couldn't stand facing the look of pity on my colleagues and students' faces. The weeks of useless treatments and medications and long-shot bone marrow transplants, the drawn-out goodbyes. 54 gray of absorbed radiation is sufficient to physically dissolve the blood-brain barrier. Before long, hemorrhages will start to bloom throughout my cerebral tissues. There will be confusion, seizures, and a coma. I'll be dead within the hour. I find myself suddenly, for the first time in my life, regretting I never had a child. I never had the time. Always chasing the next theory, groundbreaking journal article. I know my ex-wife deeply resents me for it. It's a small refrigerator in this room. If I had the energy, perhaps I could preserve a sample for future in vitro fertilization. The point is moot, of course. Now I'm as sterile as an operating room. Not a single live round left in the magazine. Oh, very well, then. If not my progeny, let my works be my legacy. 50, 100, 500, 1,000 years from now, spacecraft with radiation shields bearing my name will soar throughout the solar system and beyond, the precious human cargo inside, safe as an infant in a womb. History may speak of me using trite words like hubris and folly and sad irony, but history can shove my posthumous Nobel Prize up its judgmental ass because I will be remembered. I invented something else. It's a musical instrument in the percussion family. It's very simple to play, really. You only need three things. A 3-inch sphere of highly enriched fissile uranium, a block of tungsten carbide, and an unquenchable yearning for death's sweet embrace. Would you like to hear it? You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are such lovely blue light. More like lightning than sunshine. The other night, dear, as I lay sleeping, I dreamt I held you in my arms.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Post Culture Podcast. I'm giving up sympathy for Witch Lent. Music in this episode was provided, as usual, by Fourth Shift, who you can follow at Bandcamp, fourthshift.bandcamp.com, as well as Umbridge Hill, performing the piece you're hearing right now. You can also follow at Bandcamp. That's umbrageill.bandcamp.com. Additional music was provided by Fiddlin' John Carson and The Larks. The material in this episode was written by me, as well as three additional Twitter users. The airport piece was written by Twitter user BotAndy. who you can follow at Twitter at BOTANDY. The Affected piece was written by Twitter user BatKaren. That's at BATKAREN. And the final piece you heard there was by Sir Eviscerate on Twitter at SIREVISCERATE. The Thomas piece was written by me. Farewell for now, and I hope that all the things that are important to you are actually important.